And the problem with the middle class is that you think someone can be too rich to buy things. But that's not true. You can only be too poor.
Well, perhaps we should move on. By the way, have I spelled your surname right here?
No.
No?
But there's a perfectly logical reason why you think it's spelled that way.
Oh?
It's because of the simple fact that you're an idiot.
I'm sorry. Can you spell it out for me?
I-D-I-O-T.
I meant your name.
We'd be here all night, and some of us actually have important jobs to do, so why don't I summarize things for you? A lunatic with a gun held me and a group of poor, less well-off people hostage for half a day. You and your colleagues surrounded the building, and the whole thing was on television, but you still managed to lose the bank robber. Right now, you could have prioritized being out there trying to find the aforementioned bank robber, but instead you're sitting here sweating because you've never seen a surname with more than three consonants in it before. Your bosses couldn't make my taxes disappear faster if I'd given them matches.
I understand that you're upset.
That's very clever of you.
I just meant that you are in shock. I mean, no one expects to be threatened with a pistol when they go to view an apartment, do they? The papers may keep saying that the property market's tough these days, but taking hostages is probably going a bit far. I mean, it says in the papers one day that it's a buyer's market, then the next that it's a seller's market, but in the end, surely it's always just the damn bank's market, don't you think?
Is that supposed to be a joke?
No, it's supposed to be small talk. I just mean that the way society looks right now, the bank robber would have had considerably fewer police resources looking for him if he'd actually succeeded in robbing that bank than if he, as was actually the case, took all of you hostage. I mean, everyone hates banks. It's like people say, sometimes it's hard to know who the biggest crooks are, people who rob banks or the people who run the banks.
Do people say that?
Yes, I think so. They do, don't they? I just mean, I read in the paper yesterday about how much those bank bosses earn. They live in houses the size of palaces, worth $50 million, while ordinary people can barely manage to make their mortgage payments.
Can I ask you a question?
Of course.
Why is it that people like you always think successful people should be punished for their success?
What?
Do you do some sort of advanced conspiracy role play at police college where you're tricked into thinking that police officers get the same salary as bank bosses? Or were you all just not capable of doing a bit of basic mathematics?
Yes, well, I mean, no.
Or do you just think the world owes you something?
It's just struck me. I never asked what you do for a living.
I run a bank.
Chapter 24.
The truth is that Zara, who appears to be a little more than 50 years old, but exactly how much no one has ever dared ask, was never interested in buying the apartment. Not because she couldn't afford it, of course. She could probably have bought it with the spare change she found between the cushions on the sofa in her own apartment. Zara regarded coins as disgusting little havens of bacteria which have probably been touched by God knows how many middle-class fingers, and she'd rather have burned her sofa cushions than pick one up. So let's put it like this. She could definitely have bought that apartment for the cost of her sofa. So she went to the viewing with her nose already wrinkled, wearing diamond earrings large enough to knock out a medium-sized child, if that turned out to be necessary. But not even that, if you looked at her really closely, could hide the lurching grief inside her. The first thing you have to understand is that Zara has recently been seeing a psychologist, because Zara has the sort of career which, if you do it for long enough, sometimes means you have to seek professional help to get instructions on what you can do with your life beyond having a career. Her first meeting with the psychologist didn't go terribly well. Zara began by picking up a framed photograph from the desk and asking, "Who's that?" The psychologist replied, "My mom." Zara asked, "Do you get on well with her?" The psychologist replied, "She passed away recently." Zara asked, "And what was your relationship like before that?" The psychologist noted that a more normal response would have been to offer condolences on her death, but tried to maintain a neutral expression and said, "We're not here to talk about me." To which Zara replied, "If I'm going to leave my car with a mechanic, first I want to know if her own car is a worthless heap of junk." The psychologist took a deep breath and said, "I can understand that. So let me just say that my mom and I had a very good relationship. Is that better?" Zara nodded skeptically and asked, "Have any of your patients ever committed suicide?" The psychologist's chest tightened. She replied, "No." Zara shrugged her shoulders and added, "As far as you're aware." That was a fairly cruel thing to say to a psychologist. The psychologist, however, recovered quickly enough to say, "I only completed my training relatively recently. I haven't had that many patients, but I do know they are all still alive." "Why are you asking these questions?" Zara looked at the only picture on the walls of the psychologist's office, pursed her lips thoughtfully, and said with surprising honesty, "I want to know if you can help me." The psychologist picked up a pen, smiled a practiced smile, and said, "With what?" Zara replied that she was having trouble sleeping. She had been prescribed sleeping pills by her doctor, but now her doctor was refusing to prescribe more unless she spoke to a psychologist first. "So here I am," Zara declared, and tapped her watch, as if she were the one being paid by the hour rather than the reverse. The psychologist asked, "Do you think your trouble sleeping is related to your work? You said in your phone call that you run a bank. That sounds like it could be quite a stressful, high-pressure job." Zara replied, "Not really." The psychologist sighed and asked, "What are you hoping to accomplish during our meetings?" Zara countered at once with a question of her own. "Will this be psychiatry or psychology?" The psychologist asked, "What do you think the difference is?" Zara replied, "You need psychology if you think you're a dolphin. You need psychiatry if you've killed all the dolphins." The psychologist looked uncomfortable. The next time they met, she wasn't wearing her dolphin brooch. During their second session, Zara asked, somewhat out of the blue, "How would you explain panic attacks?" The psychologist lit up the way only psychologists can do at that question. "They're hard to define, but according to most experts, panic attacks are the experience of..." Zara interrupted. "No, I want to know how you would explain them." The psychologist shuffled uncomfortably on her chair and pondered various different answers. Eventually, she said, "I'd say that a panic attack is when psychological pain becomes so strong that it manifests itself physically. The anxiety becomes so acute that the brain can't..." Well, in the absence of any better words, I'd say that the brain doesn't have sufficient bandwidth to process all the information. The firewall collapses, so to speak, and anxiety overwhelms us.
"You're not very good at your job," Zara replied dryly.
"In what sense?"
"I already know more about you than you know about me."
"Really?"
"Your parents worked with computers, programmers, probably."
How on earth? How did you know that?"
"Has it been hard to deal with the shame of that? The fact that they did jobs that had a tangible application in the real world, whereas you work with..."
Zara fell silent abruptly and seemed to be searching for the right words. So the psychologist, somewhat affronted, filled in, "Feelings? I work with feelings."
"I was going to say fripperies, but okay, let's say feelings, if that makes you feel better."
"My dad's a programmer. My mom was a systems analyst. How did you know?"
Zara groaned, as if she were trying to teach a toaster to read.
"Does it matter?"
"Yes."
Zara groaned at the toaster again.
"When I asked you to explain panic attacks in your own words, not with the definition you learned during your training, you used the words bandwidth, process, and firewall. Words that don't fit easily into ordinary vocabulary usually come from their parents, if they had a good relationship with them."
The psychologist tried to regain the initiative in the conversation by asking,
Is this why you're good at your job at the bank? Because you can read people?
Zara stretched her back like a bored cat.
Sweetie, you aren't that hard to read. People like you are never as complicated as you'd like to be, especially not if you've been to university. Your generation don't want to study a subject, you just want to study yourselves.
The psychologist looked ever so slightly offended. Possibly more than ever so slightly.
We're here to talk about you. Zara, what are you hoping to get out of this?
Sleeping pills, like I said before. Ideally, some that will go with red wine.
I can't prescribe sleeping pills. Only your doctor can do that.
So what am I doing here, then?
Zara asked. You're the best person to answer that, the psychologist replied. That was the level on which their relationship began. Things went downhill from there. But it's worth saying at once that it wasn't at all difficult for the psychologist to make a diagnosis of this new patient. Zara was suffering from loneliness. But instead of saying that, the psychologist hadn't burdened herself with more than half a decade's worth of student debt just to learn to say what she thought. The psychologist explained that Zara was exhibiting signs that she was suffering from nervous exhaustion. Zara didn't look up from the newsfeed on her phone when she replied, "Yes, well, I'm exhausted because I can't sleep, so just get me some pills." The psychologist didn't want to do that. Instead, she started to ask questions, with the intention of helping Zara to see her own anxieties in a broader context. One of them was, "Are you worried about the survival of the planet?" Zara replied,
"Not really."
The psychologist smiled warmly. "Let me put it like this. What do you think the biggest problem with the world is?"
Zara nodded quickly and replied as if the answer were obvious.
"Poor people."
The psychologist corrected her in a friendly way.
"You mean poverty?"
Zara shrugged.
"Sure, if that feels better for you."
When they parted, Zara didn't shake hands. On her way out, she moved a photograph on the psychologist's bookcase and rearranged three books. Psychologists aren't supposed to have favorite patients, but if this psychologist had one, it definitely would not have been Zara. It wasn't until their third session that the psychologist realized how unwell Zara was. It was just after Zara had explained that democracy as a system is doomed because idiots will believe anything as long as the story's good enough. The psychologist did her best to ignore that and asked Zara instead about her childhood and work, wondering repeatedly how Zara feels. "How do you feel when that happens? How does talking about this make you feel? How do you feel when you think about how you feel? Does that feel difficult?" So in the end, Zara did feel something. They had been talking about something else for a long while, and suddenly Zara seemed to be looking deep inside her, and when she spoke, she whispered the words as if her voice were no longer her own.
"I've got cancer."
The silence in the room was so extreme that you could hear both women's heartbeats. The fingers falling flat on the notepad, the breathing that grew shallower, lungs filled no more than a third with each breath, terrified of making a noise.
"I'm truly very sorry indeed to hear that," the psychologist eventually said, her voice trembling and with carefully practiced dignity.
"I'm sorry too. Depressed, actually," Zara said and wiped her eyes.
What sort of cancer?" the psychologist asked.
"Does it matter?"
Zara whispered.
No, of course not. I'm sorry. That was insensitive of me."
Zara looked out of the window, not really seeing anything, for so long that the light outside seemed to have time to change, from morning to midday. Then she raised her chin slightly and said,
"You don't have to apologize. It's made up cancer."
Sorry?
"I haven't got cancer. I was lying. But that's what I was saying. Democracy doesn't work."
And that was when the psychologist realized what a very unwell person Zara was.
That's
"An astonishingly insensitive thing to joke about," she managed to say.
Zara raised her eyebrows.
"So it would have been better if I had cancer?"
"No! What? Absolutely not! But surely it's better to joke about it than to actually have cancer. Or would you rather I had cancer?"
The psychologist's neck flushed red with indignation.
"But no, of course I don't wish you had cancer."
Zara clasped her hands together in her lap and said in a grave tone,
"But that's how I'm feeling."
The psychologist had trouble sleeping that night. Zara sometimes has that effect on people. The next time Zara visited her office, the psychologist had removed the photograph of her mother from her desk, and during that session, Zara actually considered telling the truth about the cause of her sleeping problems. She had a letter in her bag that explained everything, and if she had only shown it then, everything that happened after that might have been different. But instead, she just sat for a long time staring at the picture on the wall. It was of a woman looking out across an endless sea toward the horizon. The psychologist moistened her lips and asked gently,
"What are you thinking when you look at that picture?"
"I'm thinking that if I had to choose just one picture to have on a wall, it wouldn't be that one."
The psychologist smiled tightly. "I usually ask my patients what they think about the woman in the picture. Who is she? Is she happy? What do you think?"
Zara's shoulders bounced nonchalantly.
"I don't know what happiness is for her."
The psychologist said nothing for a while before admitting,
"I've never heard that answer before."
Zara snorted.
"That's because you ask the question as if there's only one type of happiness. But happiness is like money."
The psychologist smiled with the superiority that only someone who thinks of themselves as being a very deep person can.
"That sounds superficial."
Zara groaned like a teenager trying to explain anything to anyone who isn't a teenager.
"I didn't say that money was happiness. I said happiness is like money, a made-up value that represents something we can't weigh or measure."
The psychologist's voice wavered just for a moment.
"Well, yes, maybe. But we can measure and evaluate the cost of depression. And we know that it's very common for people suffering from depression to be afraid of feeling happy. Because even depression can be a sort of secure bubble. It can make you start to think, if I'm not unhappy, if I'm not angry, who am I then?"
Zara wrinkled her nose.
"Do you believe that?"
"Yes."
"That's because people like you always look at people who are wealthier than you are and say, yes, they may be richer, but are they happy? As if that was the meaning of life for anyone but a complete idiot, just going around being happy all the time."
The psychologist noted something down, then asked, still looking down at her notepad,
"What is the meaning, then, in your opinion?"
Zara's reply was the response of a person who's spent many years thinking about this. Someone who has decided it was more important for her to do an important job than live a happy life.
"Having a purpose, a goal, a direction. And you want to know the truth? The truth is that far more people would rather be rich than happy."
The psychologist smiled again.
"Says the bank director to the psychologist."
Zara snorted again.
"Remind me again how much you get paid per hour. Can I come here for free if it makes me happy?"
The psychologist let out a laugh, an involuntary laugh, on the brink of unprofessional. It surprised her so much that she blushed. She made a feeble attempt to pull herself together and said,
"No, but perhaps I'd let you come here for free if it made me happy."
Then Zara suddenly let out a laugh, not consciously, but as if the sound just slipped out of her. It had been a while since that last happened. They sat in silence for a long while after that, somewhat awkwardly, until Zara finally nodded toward the woman on the wall.
"What do you think she's doing?"
The psychologist looked at the picture and blinked slowly.
"The same as everyone else. Searching."
"What for?"
The psychologist's shoulders moved up 1 inch, then down 2.
"For something to cling on to,
something to fight for, something to look forward to.
Zara took her eyes from the picture and looked past the psychologist out of the window.
What if she's thinking of committing suicide, then?
The psychologist didn't look away from the picture, just smiled and gave away none of the feelings that were raging inside her. It takes years of training and two parents you love and never want to worry to master that facial expression.
Why do you think that's what she's thinking?
Don't all intelligent people think about that sometime or other?
At first, the psychologist was going to reply with some practiced phrase she had learned during her training, but she was well aware that wouldn't help. So she replied honestly instead.
Yes, maybe. What do you think stops us?
Zara leaned forward and moved two pens on the desk so they were lying parallel. Then she said,
fear of heights.
There isn't a person on this planet who could have said there and then with any certainty if she was joking or not. The psychologist considered her next question for a long time.
Can I ask, Zara, do you have any hobbies?
Hobbies?
Zara repeated, but not in an entirely condescending way. The psychologist elaborated.
Yes. Are you involved in any charities, for instance?
Zara shook her head silently. The psychologist thought at first that it was a compliment that she didn't just fire back with an insult, but the look in Zara's eyes made her hesitate, as if the question had toppled and broken something inside her.
Are you okay? Did I say something wrong?
The psychologist asked anxiously. But Zara had already looked at the time, stood up, and was now walking to the door. The psychologist, who hadn't been a psychologist long enough not to be struck by panic at the thought of losing a patient, found herself saying something quite remarkably unprofessional.
Don't do anything silly now.
Zara stopped at the door, surprised.
Such as what?
The psychologist didn't know what to say, so she smiled awkwardly and said,
well, don't do anything silly before you've paid my bill.
Zara let out a sudden laugh. The psychologist joined in. It was harder to identify the extent to which that was also unprofessional. While Zara was standing in the elevator, the psychologist sat in her office, staring at the woman in the painting, surrounded by sky. Zara was the first person who had ever suggested that the woman might be thinking of ending her life. No one else had looked at it like that. The psychologist herself always felt that the woman was gazing off toward the horizon in a way that can only have two explanations, longing or fear. That was why she had painted the picture, as a reminder to herself. It was the sort of subject psychologists love, because you can look at it for ages without noticing the most obvious thing. The fact that the woman is standing on a bridge.
Chapter 25.
Witness interview continued. I feel stupid now. I don't suppose that's a new feeling for you. If I had known you ran a bank, obviously I wouldn't have said that. Well, I mean, I shouldn't have said it anyway. I'm not really sure what to say now. In that case, perhaps I can just leave. No, hold on. Look, this is all a bit embarrassing. My wife has often told me that I should just keep my mouth shut. I'll stick to my questions from now on, okay?
Let's give it a try.
Can you describe the robber? Anything at all that you can remember about him? Anything you think could be helpful to our investigation?
You already seem to know the most important thing.
And that is?
You said him, so you evidently know he was a man. That explains a lot.
I have a feeling I'm likely to regret asking this, but why?
You lot can't even piss without missing the target, so obviously things are going to go wrong if you get hold of a pistol.
Can I interpret that as meaning you don't remember any details about his appearance?
If someone's wearing a mask and pointing a pistol at you, a psychologist would probably compare the trauma to almost being run down by a truck. You'd be unlikely to remember the number on the license plate.
I have to say, that's a very insightful observation.
That's a relief, because what you think really matters to me.
Can I go now?
Not yet, I'm afraid. Do you recognize this drawing?
Is that what it is? It looks like someone's knocked over a urine sample.
I'll interpret that as a no to the question of whether or not you recognize the picture.
Very clever of you.
Where in the apartment were you when the bank robber came in?
By the balcony door.
And where were you during the rest of the hostage drama?
What difference does that make?
Quite a lot of difference.
I can't imagine why.
Look, you're not a suspect. Not yet, anyway.
Sorry?
Well, look, what I'm trying to get you to understand is that you need to try to understand that my colleague is convinced that one of the hostages helped the bank robber to escape. And it seems odd that you were there at all, to put it bluntly. To start with, you had no reason to want to buy the apartment. And you don't appear to have been frightened when the bank robber aimed his pistol at you.
So now you suspect that I helped the bank robber to escape?
No, no, not at all. Look, you're not a suspect at all. Well, not yet, anyway. I mean, you're not a suspect at all, but my colleague thinks it all seems a bit odd.
Really? Do you know what I think your colleague seems like?
Can you tell me what happened in the apartment, please? So I can record it. That's my job here.
Sure.
Great. How many prospective buyers were there in the apartment?
Define prospective buyers.
I mean, how many people were there who wanted to buy the apartment?
Five.
Five?
Two couples, one woman.
Plus you and the real estate agent. So seven hostages in total?
Five plus two is seven. Yes, you're very smart.
But there were eight hostages.
You haven't counted the rabbit.
The rabbit?
You heard.
What rabbit?
Do you want me to tell you what happened or not?
Sorry?
Do you seriously think one of the hostages helped the bank robber to escape?
You don't think so?
No.
Why not?
They were all idiots.
And the bank robber?
What about the bank robber?
Do you think he shot himself intentionally or by accident?
What are you talking about?
We heard a pistol shot from the apartment after you were released. When we got inside the apartment, the floor was covered in blood.
Blood? Where?
On the carpet and floor in the living room.
Oh. Nowhere else?
No.
Okay.
Sorry?
Excuse me?
When you said okay, it sounded as if you were about to say something more.
Definitely not.
Sorry. Well, my colleague is convinced it was there in the living room that he shot himself. That was what I was going to say.
And you still don't know who the bank robber is?
No.
Listen, if you don't explain soon how on earth you suspect I might be involved in this, you'll end up wishing I had called my lawyer.
No one suspects you of anything. My colleague would just like to know why you were there in the apartment, if you weren't there to buy it.
My psychologist told me I needed a hobby.
Viewing apartments is your hobby?
People like you are more interesting than you might imagine.
People like me?
People in your socioeconomic bracket. It's interesting seeing how you live, how you manage to bear it. I went to a few viewings, then a few more. It's like heroin. Have you tried heroin? You feel disgusted with yourself, but it's hard to stop.
You're telling me you've become addicted to viewing apartments owned by people who earn far less than you?
Yes, like when kids catch baby birds in glass jars. The same slightly forbidden attraction.
You mean insects? People do that with insects.
Sure, if that makes you feel better.
So you were at this apartment viewing because it's your hobby?
Is that a real tattoo on your arm?
Yes.
Is it supposed to be an anchor?
Yes.
Did you lose a bet or something?
What do you mean by that?
Was someone threatening your family, or did you do it voluntarily?
Voluntarily?
Why do people like you hate money so much?
I'm not even going to comment on that. I'd just like you to tell me, so that we've got it on tape, why the other witnesses say you didn't seem at all afraid when you saw the bank robber's pistol. Did you think it wasn't real?
I understood perfectly well that it was real. That's why I wasn't frightened. I was surprised.
That's an unusual reaction to a pistol.
For you, maybe. But I'd been contemplating killing myself for quite a long time, so when I saw the pistol, I was surprised.
I don't know what to say to that. Sorry? You'd been contemplating killing yourself?
Yes, so I was surprised when I realized that I didn't want to die. It came as a bit of a shock.
Did you start seeing your psychologist because of those suicidal thoughts?
No, I needed the psychologist because I was having trouble sleeping. Because I used to lie awake thinking that I could have killed myself if only I had enough sleeping pills.
And it was your psychologist who suggested that you needed a hobby?
Yes, that was after I told her about my cancer.
Oh, I'm very sorry to hear that. How sad.
Okay, look.
Chapter 26. The next time the psychologist and Zara met, Zara said that she had actually found a hobby. She had started to go to viewings of middle-class apartments. She said it was exciting because a lot of the apartments looked like the people who lived there did the cleaning themselves. The psychologist tried to explain that this wasn't quite what she'd had in mind by getting involved in a charity, but Zara retorted that at one of the viewings there had been a man who was thinking of renovating it himself with his own hands, the same hands he eats with, so don't try to tell me I'm not doing all I can to fraternize with the most unfortunate members of society. The psychologist had no idea how to even begin to answer that, but Zara noted her arched eyebrows and hanging jaw and snorted, "Have I upset you now? Christ, it's impossible not to upset people like you the moment you start to say anything at all." The psychologist nodded patiently and immediately regretted the question she asked next. "Can you give me an example of when people like me have been upset by you without your meaning it?" Zara shrugged, then told the story of how she had been called prejudiced when she interviewed a young man for a job at the bank, just because she had looked at him when he entered the room and exclaimed, "Oh, I would have expected you to apply for a job in the IT department instead. Your sort tend to be good with computers." Zara spent a long time explaining to the psychologist that it was actually a compliment. Does giving someone a compliment mean you're prejudiced these days, too? The psychologist tried to find a way to talk about it without actually talking about it, so she said, "You seem to get caught up in a lot of disagreements, Zara. One technique I'd recommend is to ask yourself three questions before you flare up. 1. Are the actions of the person in question intended to harm you personally? 2. Do you possess all the information about the situation? 3. Do you have anything to gain from a conflict?" Zara tilted her head so far that her neck creaked. She understood all the words, but the way they were put together made as much sense as if they'd been pulled at random from a hat. "Why would I need help to stop getting into conflicts? Conflicts are good. Only weak people believe in harmony, and as a reward, they get to float through life with a feeling of moral superiority, while the rest of us get on with other things."
"Like what?"
the psychologist wondered.
"Winning."
"And that's important?"
"You can't achieve anything if you don't win, sweetie. No one ends up at the head of a boardroom table by accident."
The psychologist tried to find her way back to her original question, whatever it had been.
"And winners earn a lot of money, which is also important, I assume? What do you do with yours?"
"I buy distance from other people."
The psychologist had never heard that response before.
"How do you mean?"
"Expensive restaurants have bigger gaps between the tables. First class on airplanes has no middle seats. Exclusive hotels have separate entrances for guests staying in suites. The most expensive thing you can buy in the most densely populated places on the planet is distance."
The psychologist leaned back in her chair. It wasn't hard to find textbook examples of Zara's personality. She avoided eye contact, didn't want to shake hands, was,
to put it mildly, empathetically challenged, and had perhaps as a result chosen to work with numbers. And she couldn't help compulsively straightening the photograph on the bookcase every time the psychologist moved it out of position on purpose before each session. It was hard to ask someone like Zara about that sort of thing directly, so the psychologist asked instead, "Why do you like your job?" "Because I'm an analyst. Most people who do the same job as me are economists," Zara replied immediately. "What's the difference?" "Economists only approach problems head-on. That's why economists never predict stock market crashes."
"And you're saying that analysts do?"
"Analysts expect crashes. Economists only earn money when things go well for the bank's customers, whereas analysts earn money all the time."
"Does that make you feel guilty?" the psychologist asked, mostly to see if Zara thought that word was a feeling or something to do with gold plating.
"Is it the croupier's fault if you lose your money at the casino?" Zara asked.
"I'm not sure that's a fair comparison."
"Why not?"
"Because you use words like stock market crash, but it's never the stock market or the banks that crash. Only people do that."
"There's a very logical explanation for why you think that."
"Really?"
"It's because you think the world owes you something. It doesn't."
"You still haven't answered my question. I asked why you like your job. All you've done is tell me why you're good at it."
"Only weak people like their jobs."
"I don't think that's true."
"That's because you like your job."
"You say that as if there's something wrong with that."
"Are you upset now? People like you really do seem to get upset an awful lot. And do you know why?"
"No."
"Because you're wrong. If you stopped being wrong the whole time, you wouldn't be so upset."
The psychologist looked at the clock on her desk. She still believed that Zara's biggest problem was her loneliness, but perhaps there's a difference between loneliness and friendlessness. But instead of saying that, the psychologist murmured in a tone of resignation,
"Do you know what? I think this might be a good place for us to stop."
Unconcerned, Zara nodded and stood up. She tucked the chair back under the table very precisely. She was half facing away when she said,
"Do you think there are bad people?"
It sounded as if she hadn't really meant to let the words out.
The psychologist did her best not to look surprised. She managed to reply,
"Are you asking me as a psychologist or from a purely philosophical perspective?"
Zara looked like she was talking to a toaster again.
"Did you have a dictionary shoved up your backside as a child, or did you end up like this of your own volition? Just answer the question. Do you think there are bad people?"
The psychologist shuffled on her seat so much that she very nearly turned her pants inside out.
"I'd probably have to say, yes, I think there are bad people."
"Do you think they know it?"
"What do you mean?"
Zara's gaze fell upon the picture of the woman on the bridge.
"In my experience, there are plenty of people who are real pigs, emotionally cold, thoughtless people. But even we don't want to believe that we're bad."
The psychologist considered her response for a long time before she replied,
"Yes, if I'm being honest, I think that almost all of us have a need to tell ourselves that we're helping to make the world better, or at least that we're not making it worse, that we're on the right side, that even if, I don't know, that maybe even our very worst actions serve some sort of higher purpose. Because practically everyone distinguishes between good and bad, so if we breach our own moral code, we have to come up with an excuse for ourselves. I think that's known as neutralizing techniques in criminology. It could be religious or political conviction or the belief that we had no choice, but we need something to justify our bad deeds. Because I honestly believe that there are very few people who could live with knowing that they are bad." Zara said nothing, just clutched her far too large handbag a little too tightly, and for just a fraction of a second, looked like she was about to admit something. Her hand was halfway to the letter. She even allowed herself, very fleetingly, to entertain the possibility of confessing that she had lied about her hobby. She hadn't only just started going to apartment viewings. She'd been going to them for 10 years. It wasn't a hobby. It was an obsession. But none of the words slipped out. She closed her bag, the door slid shut behind her, and the room fell silent. The psychologist remained seated at her desk, bemused at how bemused she felt. She tried to make some notes for their next encounter, but found herself instead opening her laptop and looking at the details of apartments for sale. She tried to figure out which of them Zara was thinking of looking at next, which was obviously impossible, but it could have been simple if only Zara had explained that all the apartments she looked at had to have balconies, and that all the balconies had to have a view that stretched all the way to the bridge. In the meantime, Zara was standing in the elevator. Halfway down, she pressed the emergency stop button so she could cry in peace. The letter in her handbag was still unopened. Zara had never dared read it, because she knew the psychologist was right. Zara was one of the people who, deep down, wouldn't be able to live with knowing that about herself. Chapter 27. This is a story about a bank robbery, an apartment viewing, and a hostage drama. But even more, it's a story about idiots. But perhaps not only that. 10 years ago, a man wrote a letter. He mailed it to a woman at a bank. Then he dropped his kids off at school, whispered in their ears that he loved them, drove off on his own, and parked his car by the water. He climbed onto the railing of a bridge and jumped. The following week, a teenage girl was standing on the same bridge railing. Obviously, it doesn't really make any difference to you who the girl was. She was just one person out of several billion, and most people never become individuals to us. They're just people. We're just strangers passing each other, your anxieties briefly brushing against mine as the fibers of our coats touch momentarily on a crowded sidewalk somewhere. We never really know what we do to each other, with each other, for each other. But the teenage girl on the bridge was called Nadia. It was the week after the man had jumped to his death from the railing where she was standing. She knew next to nothing about who he was, but she went to the same school as his children, and everyone was talking about it. That was how she got the idea. No one can really explain, either before or after, what makes a teenager stop wanting to be alive. It just hurts so much at times. Being human. Not understanding yourself, not liking the body you're stuck in, seeing your eyes in the mirror and wondering whose they are, always with the same question: what's wrong with me? Why do I feel like this? She isn't traumatized. She isn't weighed down by any obvious grief. She's just sad all the time. An evil little creature that wouldn't have shown up on any x-rays was living in her chest, rushing through her blood and filling her head with whispers, saying she wasn't good enough, that she was weak and ugly and would never be anything but broken. You can get it into your head to do some unbelievably stupid things when you run out of tears, when you can't silence the voices no one else can hear, when you've never been in a room where you felt normal. In the end, you get exhausted from always tensing the skin around your ribs, never letting your shoulders sink, brushing along walls all your life with white knuckles, always afraid that someone will notice you, because no one's supposed to do that. All Nadia knew was that she had never felt like someone who had anything in common with anyone else. She had always been entirely alone in every emotion. She sat in a classroom full of her contemporaries, looking like everything was the same as usual, but inside, she was standing in a forest, screaming until her heart burst.
The trees grew until one day the sunlight could no longer break through the foliage, and the darkness in there became impenetrable. So she stood on a bridge looking over the railing to the water far below, and knew it would be like hitting concrete when she landed. She wouldn't drown, just die on impact. That thought consoled her, because ever since she was very little, she'd been scared of drowning. Not death itself, but the moments before it. The panic and powerlessness. A thoughtless adult had told her that a person who's drowning doesn't look like they're drowning. When you're drowning, you can't call for help. You can't wave your arms. You just sink. Your family can be standing on the beach, waving cheerfully to you, completely unaware that you're dying. Nadia had felt like that all her life. She had lived among them, had sat at the dinner table with her parents thinking, "Can't you see?" But they didn't see, and she didn't say anything. One day, she simply didn't go to school. She tidied her room and made her bed and left home without a coat because she wouldn't be needing one. She spent all day in town, freezing, wandering around as if she wanted the town to see her one last time and understand what it had done by failing to hear her silent screams. She didn't have any real plan, just a consequence. When sunset came, she found herself standing on the railing of the bridge. It was so easy. All she had to do was move one foot, then the other. It was that teenage boy called Jack who saw her. He couldn't explain why he'd gone back to the bridge, evening after evening, for a week. His parents had forbidden it, of course, but he never listened. He snuck out and ran there as if he were hoping to see the man standing there again, so he could turn back the clock and make everything right this time. When he saw the teenage girl on the railing instead, he didn't know what to shout at her, so he didn't shout anything. He just rushed over and pulled her down with such force that she hit the back of her head on the tarmac and was knocked unconscious. She woke up in the hospital. Everything had happened so quickly that she had only caught a glimpse of the boy rushing toward her out of the corner of her eye. When the nurses asked what had happened, she wasn't even sure of that herself, but the back of her head was bleeding, so she said she'd climbed up onto the railing to take a photograph of the sunset, then fell backward and hit her head. She was so used to saying what she knew other people wanted to hear, so they wouldn't worry, that she did it without thinking. The nurses still looked worried, suspicious, but she was a good liar. She'd spent her whole life practicing. So in the end, they said, "Climbing up on that railing, what a silly thing to do. It's sheer luck you didn't slip off the other side instead." She nodded, dry-lipped, and said, "Yes, luck." She could have gone straight back to the bridge from the hospital, but she didn't. It was impossible to explain why, even to herself, because she would never know for sure what she would have done if that boy hadn't pulled her down. Would she have taken a step forward or back? So every day after that, she tried to understand the difference between herself and the man who had jumped. That drove her to choose a profession, a career, a whole life. She became a psychologist. The people who came to her were the ones who were in so much pain that it felt like they were standing on a railing with one foot over the edge. And she sat in her chair opposite them with eyes that said, "I've been here before. I know a better way down." Of course, sometimes she couldn't help thinking about the reasons why she had wanted to jump, all the things she thought were missing from her reflection, her loneliness at the dinner table. But she found ways to cope, to tunnel her way out of herself, to climb down. Some people accept that they will never be free of their anxiety. They just learn to carry it. She tried to be one of them. She told herself that was why you should always be nice to other people, even idiots, because you never know how heavy their burden is. Over time, she realized that deep down, almost everyone asks themselves the same sort of questions. Am I good? Do I make anyone proud? Am I useful to society? Am I good at my job? Generous and considerate? A decent shag? Does anyone want me to be their friend? Have I been a good parent? Am I a good person?
people want to be good, deep down. Kind. The problem, of course, is that it isn't always possible to be kind to idiots, because they're idiots. That's become a lifelong project for Nadia to grapple with, as it is for all of us. She never met the boy from the bridge again. Sometimes she honestly believes that she made him up. An angel, maybe. Jack never saw Nadia again either. He never went back to the bridge. But that was the day his plan to become a police officer became unshakable, when he realized that he could be the difference. 10 years later, Nadia will move back to the town after training to become a psychologist. She will acquire a patient named Zara. Zara will go to an apartment viewing and get caught up in a hostage drama. Jack and his dad, Jim, will interview all the witnesses. The apartment where it happened has a balcony from which you can see all the way to the bridge. That's why Zara is there. 10 years ago, she found a letter on her doormat written by a man who jumped. His name was written neatly on the back of the envelope. She remembered their meeting. And even though the newspapers never published the name of the person the police found in the water, the town was too small for her not to know. Zara still carries the letter around with her in her handbag every day. She's only been down to the bridge once, the week after he climbed onto the railing. She saw a girl climb up onto the same railing and a boy who rescued her. Zara didn't even move. She just stood hidden in the darkness, shaking. She was still standing there when the ambulance arrived and took the girl to the hospital. The boy vanished. Zara walked out onto the bridge and found the girl's wallet and ID card with her name on it. Nadia. Zara has spent 10 years following Nadia's life and education and the start of her career in secret, from a distance, because she's never dared approach her. She has spent 10 years looking at the bridge, also from a distance, from the balconies of apartments that are for sale, for the same reason. Because she's afraid that if she goes down to the bridge again, maybe someone else will jump. And if she seeks out Nadia and discovers the truth about herself, perhaps it will be Zara who does it. Because Zara is human enough to want to hear what the difference is between that man and Nadia, even though she realizes that she doesn't really want to know. That she bears the guilt. That she's the bad person. Maybe everyone says they'd like to know that about themselves, but no one does really. So Zara still hasn't opened the envelope. The whole thing is a complicated, unlikely story. Perhaps that's because what we think stories are about often isn't what they're about at all. This, for instance, might not actually be the story of a bank robbery, or an apartment viewing, or a hostage drama. Perhaps it isn't even a story about idiots. Perhaps this is a story about a bridge. Chapter 28. The truth? The truth is that that damn real estate agent was a damn poor real estate agent. And the apartment viewing was a disaster right from the start. If the prospective buyers couldn't agree about anything else, they could at least agree on that. Because nothing unites a group of strangers more effectively than the opportunity to come together and sigh at a hopeless case. The advertisement, or whatever you want to call it, was a poorly spelled disaster, with pictures so blurred that the photographer seemed to believe that a panoramic shot was something you achieved by throwing your camera across the room. The house tricks estate agency. House tricks, it said above the date. And who on earth would get it into their head to hold an apartment viewing the day before New Year's Eve? There were scented candles in the bathroom and a bowl of limes on the coffee table, a brave effort by someone who seemed to have heard about apartment viewings but had never actually been to one. But the closet was stuffed with clothes, and there was a pair of slippers in the bathroom that looked like they belonged to someone who had spent the past 50 years shuffling around without ever lifting their feet. The bookcase was packed and not even color-coordinated, and there were even more books piled up on the windowsills and the kitchen table. The fridge was covered with yellowing drawings produced by the owner's grandchildren.
Zara had been to enough viewings by this point to be able to spot an amateur. A viewing should make it look as if no one lives in the apartment, because otherwise only a serial killer would want to move in. A viewing should make it look as if anyone could potentially live there. People don't want to buy a picture, they want to buy a frame. They can handle books in a bookcase, but not on the kitchen table. Perhaps Zara could have gone up to the real estate agent and pointed that out, if only the real estate agent hadn't been a human being, and if only Zara hadn't hated human beings, especially when they spoke. Instead, Zara did a circuit of the apartment, trying to look interested, the way she had seen people who actually wanted to buy apartments look. That was quite a challenge for her, seeing as only someone on drugs who collected fingernail clippings could possibly be interested in living in this particular apartment. So when no one was looking in her direction, Zara went out onto the balcony, stood by the railing, and stared off toward the bridge until she started to shake uncontrollably. The same reaction as always, time after time for the past 10 years. The letter she had never opened lay in her handbag. She had learned to cry almost without tears now, for practical reasons. The balcony door was ajar, and she could hear voices, not just in her head, but from inside the apartment. Two married couples were wandering about, trying to ignore all the rather ugly furniture, and instead visualize their own really ugly furniture in its place. The older couple had been married for a long time, but the younger couple seemed to have only gotten married recently. You can always tell by the way people who love each other argue. The longer they've been together, the fewer words they need to start a fight. The older couple were called Annalena and Roger. They've been retired for a few years now, but clearly not long enough for them to have gotten used to it. They were always stressing about something, but without having anything they truly needed to hurry for. Annalena was a woman with strong feelings, and Roger a man with strong opinions. And if you've ever wondered who writes all those too detailed 1 out of 5 star reviews of household gadgets, or theater plays, or tape dispensers, or small glass ornaments on the internet, it's Annalena and Roger. Sometimes, of course, they hadn't even tried out the gadgets in question, but they weren't the sort of people to let that stop them from writing a scathing review. If you had to try things out and read things and find out the truth about things, then you'd never have time to have an opinion about anything. Annalena was wearing a top in a color usually only seen on parquet floors. Roger was in jeans and a checkered shirt that had received a sulfurous 1 out of 5 stars review online because it had shrunk several inches, not long after Roger's bathroom scale had received the damning judgment that it was calibrated wrong. Annalena tugged at one of the curtains and said, "Green curtains? Who on earth has green curtains? Honestly, the things people do these days. But maybe they're colorblind. Or Irish." She didn't say this to anyone in particular. She had just fallen into the habit of thinking out loud, seeing as that seemed appropriate for a woman who had gotten used to the fact that no one listened to her anyway. Roger was kicking the baseboards and muttering, "This one's loose," and didn't hear a word of what Annalena said. The baseboard may possibly have been loose because Roger had spent 10 minutes kicking it, but for a man like Roger, a truth is a truth, regardless of its cause. From time to time, Annalena whispered to him about what she thought of the other prospective buyers in the apartment. Sadly, Annalena was about as good at whispering as she was at thinking quietly, so it was pretty much the sort of shouted whisper that's the equivalent of a fart in an airplane that you think won't be noticed if you let it out a little bit at a time. You never manage to be as discreet as you imagine. "That woman on the balcony? Roger, what does she want with this apartment? She's obviously too rich to want it, so what's she doing here? And she's still got her shoes on? Everyone knows you take your shoes off at an apartment viewing." Roger didn't answer. Annalena glared at Zara through the balcony window as if Zara were the one who'd farted. Then Annalena leaned even closer to Roger and whispered, "And those women in the hall, they really don't look like they could afford to live here, do they?" At this, Roger stopped kicking the baseboard, turned toward his wife, and looked her deep in the eye. Then he said 4 little words that he never said to any other woman on the planet. He said, "For God's sake, darling." They never argue anymore, unless perhaps they argue all the time.
When you've been stuck with each other long enough, it can seem like there's no difference between no longer arguing and no longer caring. For God's sake, darling, remember to tell everyone you talk to that this place needs serious renovation. That way they won't want to put in an offer, Roger went on. Annalena looked confused.
But that's good, isn't it?
Roger sighed. For God's sake, darling. Good for us, yes, because we can do the renovations. But the others, you can tell from miles off that none of them knows a thing about renovation. Annalena nodded, wrinkled her nose, and sniffed the air demonstratively.
There's a definite smell of damp, isn't there? Possibly even mold?
Because Roger had taught her always to ask the real estate agent that question, loudly, so that the other prospective buyers would hear and be worried. Roger closed his eyes in frustration. For God's sake, darling, you're supposed to say that to the realtor, not me. Wounded, Annalena nodded, then thought out loud,
I was just practicing.
Zara could hear them from where she was standing, looking out over the railing on the balcony. The same swirling panic inside her, the same nausea, the same quivering fingertips every time she saw the bridge. Maybe she was fooling herself by thinking that one day it would feel better, or perhaps worse, so unbearable that she herself went and jumped. She looked down from the balcony but wasn't sure it was high enough. That's the only thing someone who definitely wants to live and someone who definitely wants to die have in common. If you're going to jump off something, you need to be pretty damn sure of the height. Zara just wasn't sure which of those she was. Just because you don't much like life doesn't necessarily mean you want the alternative. So she had spent a decade seeking out and attending these apartment viewings, standing on balconies and staring at the bridge, balancing right in the middle of all that was worst inside her. She heard new voices from inside the apartment. It was the other couple, the younger pair, Julia and Ro. One of them was a blonde, the other had black hair, and they were squabbling noisily the way you do when you're young and think that every feeling fluttering about in all your hormones is completely unique. Julia was the one who was pregnant, and Ro was the one who was irritated. One was dressed in clothes that looked like she'd made them herself out of capes she'd stolen from murdered magicians, the other as if she sold drugs outside a bowling alley. Ro, that was a nickname, of course, but the sort that had stuck to her for so long that even she used it to introduce herself, which was just one of the many reasons Zara found her irritating, was walking around and holding her phone up toward the ceiling, repeating, "There's, like, no signal at all in here," while Julia snapped back,
"Well, that's terrible, because then we might actually have to talk to each other if we lived here. Stop trying to change the subject the whole time. We need to make a decision about the birds."
They very rarely agreed about anything, but in Ro's defense, she didn't always know that. Fairly often when Ro asked Julia, "Are you upset?" Julia would reply, "No," and Ro would shrug, as carefree as a family in an advertising for cleaning products, which obviously only made Julia even more upset, because it was perfectly obvious that she was upset. But this time, even Ro was aware that they were arguing, because they were arguing about the birds. Ro had had birds when she and Julia got together. Not as lunch, but as pets. "Is she a pirate?" Julia's mom had asked the first time it was mentioned. But Julia put up with the birds because she was in love and because she couldn't help wondering how long birds could actually live. A very long time, as it turned out. When Julia eventually realized this and tried to deal with the situation in an adult way by sneaking out of bed one night and letting them out of a window, one of the wretched creatures fell all the way to the street and died. A bird. Julia had to invite some of the neighbor's children in for a soda the next day when Ro was at work, so she could blame one of them when Ro found the cage open. And the other birds? They were still sitting in the cage. What sort of insult to evolution was it that creatures like that managed to stay alive? "I'm not going to have them put down, and I don't want to talk about it anymore," Ro said, sounding hurt and looking around the apartment with her hands deep in the pockets of her dress. Her dress had pockets, because she appreciated looking nice, but still liked to have somewhere to put her hands.
Okay. So what do you think of the apartment, then? I think we should take it," Julia said breathlessly,
because the elevator was broken, and every time Rose said, "We're pregnant," to family and friends as if it were a team sport, Julia felt like pouring molten wax in her ears when she was asleep. Not that Julia didn't love Ro, because she did, so much that it was almost unbearable. But they had looked at more than 20 apartments in the past 2 weeks, and Ro always found something wrong with every single one of them. It was as if she didn't actually want to move. But Julia woke up every night in their current apartment to play every pregnant woman's favorite game, kick or gas. And then she couldn't get back to sleep because both Ro and the birds snored. So she was more than ready to move anywhere right now, as long as it had more than one bedroom.
"No signal," Ro repeated morosely.
"Who cares? Let's take it,"
Julia persisted.
"Well, I'm not sure. I need to check the hobby room," Ro said.
"That's a walk-in closet,"
Julia corrected.
"Or a hobby room. I'm just going to get the tape measure," Ro nodded cheerfully, because one of her most charming and simultaneously most infuriating characteristics was that no matter what they'd just been arguing about, she could be in a wonderful mood in the blink of an eye if she thought about cheese.